Thank you very much, Phil, for so movingly giving us the human face of complementary protection, which James so skillfully outlined for us. And could I join with those who, like Phil, don't think we should shy away from love any more than we shy away from concepts like respect and dignity, which are at the very heart of human rights. They may not of themselves be enough, but you know, they are not a bad start, and if they inform the way we go forward, I think we can only go forward in the right direction. So we now have time for questions of our speakers or any observations. Yes, thank you.
As far as your current, that last comment of yours, or the love, etc., etc., you're obviously preaching the thin dirt here, but underlying it isn't really that all the concept of human rights, which we label as a ministry of really depends on the international sphere. An acceptance that person overseas, you know, a country of a different appearance, is actually my brother. That they are entitled to the same as I am. That, to me, is the fundamental point which has got lost over the last few years. How do you suggest we address that or deal with this?
Thank you. Thanks for the question. Use both sides of the page. It won't take long. I think that's right. Maybe the first step in this, talking more generally, is to start to reclaim the language. There has been war has been waged on the rights agenda in this country, particularly those of us involved with Indigenous rights in the country, to the point where people wanted to bury the whole. You know, how are we going to find a way to actually describe this? And I think we have to reclaim the rights agenda. The human rights count, and human rights are important. You know, and part of that is to say that the primacy of the person, to use a term that Martin Luther King used to constantly refer to. What does that mean? It means, I think, if you look at some of the research that's been done in recent years, and I'll quote some by that pinko crypto ratbag socialist organisation, the Sir Vincent de Paul. Who did some work with ACOS to look at an analysis of the language in the public discourse over the course of the last 15 to 20 years. And they found that, you know, increasingly we no longer live together in a society. We live together in an economy. Why is that significant? If you're in a society, you're a citizen who has rights, has responsibilities. If you live in an economy, you're a customer or a consumer with access to how much of the folding you've got. And so it's about the... on one side of that paradigm, we say, okay, here we value people for who they are, citizens with rights and responsibilities. On the other side of that, here we value people for what they can do, what they can achieve, what they can spend. It's a commodification of the person that's occurred. And if you listen to the public debate, that's what you hear. Listen to Alan Jones every morning, that's what you get. So there's got to be some reclaiming of the language, I think, initially. But also there's got to be the grabbing of the political will, and that's where the people come into play, where I think we've got to get smarter. Those of us in the human rights movement have not exactly fought the fight appropriately, I think. Or as Chris Sidoti says, we failed for not engaging strongly enough. I had a very senior federal politician referring to this work the other day say to me, the trouble with this bloody stuff is that the politics takes you that way and the principle takes you that way. It seems to me that we've got to somehow get back to that. And finally, it seems that this happened because people were nameless and faceless. It could be labelled illegal asylum seeker, even though seeking asylum is a perfectly legal thing to do in Australia. You had the Cardinal Archbishop of Sydney recently saying when people stayed back after World Youth Day, hit them with the full force of the law. Well, say, well, good, because the full force of the law entitles them to seek asylum. So I think there needs to be very much a mobilisation of that particular will to debunk those myths. And that's where I want to pay public credit to the work that's been done by this commission, who continually have published and republished and under great political difficulty the documents that debunk the myths about Indigenous people, that debunk the myths about asylum seekers. And then the task for the rest of us is to get that and spread it around.
Yes, I just wanted to ask you a question about
Just to ask you a question of Dr. McAdam about the Article 1 of the second optional protocol to the ICCPR, whether or not which says that no one within the jurisdiction of a state party to the present protocol shall be executed, which protects a person from being sent to a place where they would be executed, is that ever interpreted by states to try to reduce that protection so that they would only send, that they would be able to return somebody to a state who is not signatory to the second protocol of the ICCPR, or is it generally viewed by states as covering all execution?
As far as I know, it's seen as covering, I mean, it doesn't matter whether that's, well, it doesn't matter whether the state to which the person is sent or proposed to be sent is itself a signatory to the optional protocol or not. It's because the obligation is on the sending state. And so if you've, you know, Australia has outlawed the death penalty, therefore Australia is bound never to, you know, under this view, never to send any person back to a state where they are themselves at risk. It's not, we can no longer send someone to any country that still has the death penalty, but where the particular individual is at risk. And, I mean, that's caused some, led to some interesting cases with the US as well, certain states of the US, with Canada and the US in particular. And the case I referred to where the Human Rights Committee goes into detail is called Judge and Canada. So if you're interested, if you judge as in a judge, that's just the person's name, and you can find their elaboration of that principle there.
Sorry, Jane, I've got a question for you as well. I wanted to ask if you could provide a bit more guidance in respect of the 2004 Qualification Directive and its supervisory body, the ECJ. What impact do you think that that has on the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights in terms of the questions they're being asked in terms of Article 3 applications, where everything's now going to the ECJ under the terms of the directive?
Okay, this is a new relationship that's emerging, and it's at the moment sort of unclear how those two courts are going to, you know, manage that, although the signs are that the ECJ is quite respectful of the European Court of Human Rights jurisprudence. It's not that individual cases will be taken to the European Court of Justice, but rather that member states of the EU can refer questions of interpretation to the European Court of Justice about the meaning of certain provisions in the Qualification Directive. And so that's, for example, the Netherlands seeking this preliminary ruling on the meaning of Article 15C. The ECJ is not familiar really, I mean, they haven't dealt with asylum law ever before, and so there's a real concern that the court, you know, the court isn't experienced with this kind of this kind of law, and really is a bit flummoxed about what to do. So I think it's quite open to looking at European Court of Human Rights jurisprudence in interpreting that. But it's really early days yet. So I was recently doing a workshop over there about all of this, and that was one of the questions. You know, what's the relationship between the European Court of Justice and the European Court of Human Rights on this? The other thing too is that you're getting different interpretations coming up through the national courts, which in turn may influence what the European Court of Human Rights does if it gets an for people who aren't familiar with this must just seem so crazy, but basically individuals can take a case to the European Court of Human Rights on, for example, fear of removal because of torture. So if the UK knocks you back and you've got a negative decision, you can go there and say, you know, I'm taking my case now against the United Kingdom because I ought to be protected. And whatever the European Court of Human Rights says about your case, you know, that's the decision. The United Kingdom must respect it. By contrast, the European Court of Justice's role is not about individual cases so much as the interpretation of what the particular legislation means. And that's why there's this kind of cross-cutting or bypassing of the the different jurisprudence. Sorry, there's a very convoluted answer to say we don't know yet.
Is there a question?
Thanks, Jane. Thanks, Phil, very much. It's a question to both of you. I'd just like to push you a little on the statelessness issue and how you, what particular suggestions you might have for how we deal with that, either in the context of a system of complementary protection or in some other way.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, as I pointed out, no other country has formally included statelessness as a ground for complementary protection, and it seems to be one of the obvious categories that's been left out. Part of the reason, I think, has been because there is in international law a separate regime envisaged. Interestingly, the rights that stateless people ought to have are pretty much parallel to convention refugee rights, with the kind of final point being that we should be moving to naturalising stateless persons. So, I mean, a very technical legal answer would be to say, well, we've already got a regime in place, we just need to implement that. But the point is that it's not being fully respected. And this seems to me a convenient mechanism to introduce, you know, to include statelessness as a possible ground for obtaining, you know, protection. But it would be, you know, I mean, no other country has actually done it that way. So it seems to me that the time is kind of ripe, though, for bundling this up within this kind of, you know, suite of grounds on which protection could be claimed. Because what we're also talking about is, you know, that's another international treaty that has a basis on which people are in need of a form of protection. So why not include it here?
Dr. McCallum, I'd like to ask you a question. In the evolvement of the complementary protection draft, is there a suggestion that the Section 417 discretion will be removed from the Minister in that? Because I see this as very important. Minister Evans has already stated that he believes that he has far too much discretion and he wants the Department to take more responsibility. Those of us in the advocacy movement don't have a lot of faith in the department's evolvement of adhering to the law, because they use the law in a very negative way at many times, individual case officers and so on. Is there a suggestion that 417 discretionary powers may be removed if the complementary protection is brought in?
As far as I'm aware, there hasn't been a suggestion that the powers would go. Someone might want to correct me on that. But I mean, what I would see as being very important is that we still need a residual discretion for certain cases. I mean, complementary protection is about the you know, hard legal obligations that exist, but there remain humanitarian and compassionate cases that will fall outside those grounds. You know, for example, where someone's very elderly or very ill or for family reasons needs to remain. So I think there should be a residual discretion. Presumably what would happen, though, is that people would bring a claim based on torture through the kind of upfront legislative grounds. Whether or not, presumably if they're unsuccessful making that claim on that codified legal basis, then they presumably wouldn't be able to then go and ask for the minister to exercise his discretion on exactly the same grounds, unless there is also a compassionate claim attached to that. And I'm not sure whether that the relationship between the discretion and the codified complementary protection has been thought through extensively yet. But my understanding is that a discretion will remain.
Sorry, before we move on, could I say something about that from my perspective, from my former position? It is, I think, critical either that the 417 remain or that something else be done for the people who run their cases in front of, for example, the Refugee Review Tribunal and are knocked back, are often on grounds of credibility and later come into possession of material which is very compelling in support of their case. Under the current regime, only Section 417 is available to those people. They can't start a refugee claim again on the later material. And that is one very compelling reason to have a let-out clause. Yes. Was there another question at the back?
Hi, everyone. Phil, I wanted to ask you what, if any, steps or response you've had from the department or the minister in terms of addressing the issues that you've arisen for particular particular people that you've highlighted?
I think there's a the minister is certainly taking the issue very seriously. We've had discussions with his office and with him, and I have been heartened by that. I find it a little bit difficult at the same time that when it comes to dealing with members of the department, there's a sense of ringing journalists to brief them just as recently as last Friday when the piece was going to the Herald to say, whatever you do, these things are terribly difficult to substantiate, and sort of trying to talk it down. I think the minister has taken this issue tremendously seriously. He's called for an investigation into the processes that took place on Nauru. He's called for information about these cases to look into whether incorrect decisions were made. He's basically said it would be very, very difficult to bring people back or to reopen those cases, because then you would have to admit that something seriously went wrong. Our position is that something very seriously went wrong. And we're asking for two things, that the cases need to be reopened for those who would want to have their cases reopened who were on Nauru, and secondly, that the Australia needs to use its good offices both unilaterally and multilaterally to ensure that those people can be resettled somewhere in safety. We would congratulate and heartily support the Minister's removal and ending of the Pacific Solution. And even that language, the Pacific Solution, has awful echoes to it, doesn't it? The Pacific Solution. But of course, the Pacific Solution hasn't ended. It hasn't ended. The 400 who went back to Afghanistan remain its victims. And their situation is now made far worse because of the fact of that which happened there. Of course, the 400 who stayed on Nauru and refused to accept the offers that Afghanistan was now safe have all been resettled. The frustration, of course, for gentlemen that we sat there who's lost family members, whose children have been killed after going back, is the final realisation that if they had stayed, they would still be here. So it seems that we have a moral obligation. It's a harder argument to say we have a legal obligation. But my God, we have a human obligation to ensure that the human rights of these people need to be put right. I think the minister, frankly, is making an excellent start on this issue, and he needs to be encouraged, not belted up for it. I do find it depressing that some members of the department, on the one hand, are seeking to provide support, and others are seeking to try and make the issue go away. And I would have to say this, though. You can't do this work unless people from within the department are prepared to cooperate. We didn't find these people by accident. There are good people in the Department of Immigration who for years and years were deeply concerned and troubled by this. And without their very brave and courageous support and provision of information, it wouldn't be possible. So I have hope, but we need that hope to be mobilised.
Thank you. I think we have to finish questions now if we're to have the break and then watch the film. But I think it was a useful note to close on, which is that none of the things we're concerned about suggests that decision-making in this area is easy. We know that there are tragic, heart-wrenching cases that go wrong, but we also know that there are people who do tell stories which lack truth, and the decision-makers are in a most awful and difficult position. Many of us are critical of things that have happened in the past in the department, but that doesn't mean that we don't applaud the minister in his moves forward, and we don't recognise that there are people in that department who are working hard to improve the culture of the department, and our role, I think, is to support them in the good work that they're seeking to do. So let us close now by thanking, just for a short time, we're about to have 10 minutes or so break with some light refreshments, close by thanking our two speakers very much for their, I think, wonderful contributions, which have helped all of us understand more clearly both the legal background to this human tragedy, and also to get a feel, which no doubt we'll have even more strongly at the end of the film, of the human face of this tragedy. Now, I know I have two very small gifts to offer to our speakers. and so in the hope that you both drink alcohol or have friends that do, could I offer you bottles of wine on behalf of the Commission? Thank you.